Levenger.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ty Clevenger. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Wade Robertson. As the court knows, this is an interlocutory appeal of a preliminary injunction. The trial court attached in excess of $600,000. The first issue, I think, is very straightforward. On the issue of attachment, we've argued in the brief, cited DC Code Section 16-501, which requires first, the filing of an affidavit in support of the attachment, and second, the posting of bond in twice the amount of the claim prior to attachment. It is undisputed by the parties that this never happened.
Right, but if there's authority under, what is the rule, 65, under the federal rules, then we don't need to worry about the local statute, isn't that right?
Well, that's true, except for the fact the federal rules incorporate the D.C. statute.
But Rule 65 doesn't. Only Rule 64 does.
That's true. But I don't think that Rule 65 would apply in this case because this is a standard seizure. It's a standard attachment. The court is basically seizing this, and I would actually direct the court's attention to our brief on page 25 where we've quoted what the trial court said. The district court found irreparable injury and made an attachment because, quote, it had no evidence that Mr. Robertson has any money that he could use to satisfy any judgment for Dr. Cartenauer in this case, other than money that appears to have come from Mr. Cartenauer. And then it further found, quote, he has to maintain this money so that he can, that is Mr. Robertson, if there's going to be a judgment, that Mr. Cartenauer can recover and that the money not be dissipated based upon his past history, that the money will be gone unless it's frozen. And so this is really a rather radical jurisprudence here.
Why is it radical? Why isn't this the imposition of a constructive trust on money that a partnership fiduciary, took out of the partnership funds, transferred to himself? That's the way the court is describing it, and I appreciate you dispute that,
sure,
that description. But the court's description is that this is a partnership. The money is taken out of the partnership, either by fraud or by an agreement that's unconscionable, and they can trace the funds directly. They know exactly where those funds are. The court can impose a constructive trust. That's a typical equitable action by the court.
Well, first, Your Honor, I would point out that $132,000 of this money was not even traceable to the partnership. And the reason this is radical,
all of this would be much more compelling, indeed maybe radical, if there weren't a prior violation of the court's order.
Well, Your Honor, there was not a violation of the court's order, I submit, because
the district judge viewed the matter that way, right? Isn't that the
certainly
foundation on which he proceeded?
That is her
so
perception.
We'll come back to whether that's faulty or not, if you like. But
yes, and that's,
given that foundation where the proceeding under the less radical approach seemed to have been frustrated, and there's therefore reason to think might be frustrated again, there doesn't seem to be anything particularly venturesome about the district court's further action here.
Well, Your Honor, the reason I would submit that it is venturesome is because the court shifts the burden of proof and essentially says, I'm convinced that her reason for issuing this order is that she says she's convinced that my client cannot pay a judgment. And so based on that, because he cannot provide any evidence that he can pay the judgment, she's not just going to attach things that are traceable to the partnership. There's no evidence that the $132,000, and that's in the brief, there's no evidence that $132,000 was in any way connected to this partnership. She's going in and saying, not in his capacity as a member of the partnership.
Suppose that the partner, that your client, or in another case, the defending partner has wasted or hidden all of the partnership assets, and so the only assets that he might have at all are personal assets. Is that the end of the matter? Then the court can't do anything about it.
Well, this is an equitable matter. It's a question, if the issue is money damages, and the law is relatively clear as we set forth in the brief, if it's the money damages, if that's the remedy.
That's, again, perfectly innocuous at the outset of the case. But once the court determines that there's been a violation of a previous order, it changes,
Your Honor,
everything, doesn't it?
Sure, but I would, again, direct the court back to that order and back to the facts that we cited in the record. Yes, she concluded that her order had been violated, But if you go and freeze the assets of the partnership, and meanwhile my client from his personal accounts draws some money out, and then the court says, you violated my order because you removed partnership accounts or partnership funds, and the evidence is simply not there that these were even partnership funds, that's a fundamentally different issue.
So the respondent said in their brief that the freeze had been violated. Did you dispute that in your brief? Is that the argument you're making?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that in the brief or in a reply?
It was in the original brief. I don't have the page. If I may, on rebuttal.
Yeah, on a rebuttal.
Sure.
So there's a page in there where you say that your client did not breach the freeze.
Yes, Your Honor. The other big issue, and this goes to the issue of the likelihood of success on the merits, I do want to focus on the limitations issue. There are a lot of scandalous allegations made against my client that if they were true, he should be disbarred. But that's not the issue I brought, but it's not true, but that's not the issue I brought in front of the court. The issue is rather specific on limitations. And more so than that, the issue is the enforceability of contracts. This whole dispute is bookended by two major events. At the outset of the partnership in 2004, Dr. Kartenhauer makes factual statements and says that I have had the opportunity to consult with counsel. I have consulted with counsel. He even says, my counsel advised me not to do this, but I'm doing it anyway. That's in the contract in 2004. Then in 2006, April of 2006, he comes back and goes before a notary public and signs another document saying that he's aware of all these things, he's releasing everything, and I'll cite you the appendix record on this, because this is critical to the issue of limitations. He is making all these statements, and then when he wants to bring the lawsuit, well, he comes in and disavows it. I want to direct your attention to one quote in particular. This is on page 23 of the appellee's brief. It says the release, quote, is unconscionable in that it falsely states that Kartenhauer had the opportunity to review the document with counsel. Now, I would bring to your attention, there is no it. The it doesn't falsely state anything. It's the parties who are making these statements. And it's not as if this document's written in Latin. It's not a matter of understanding the legalese.
Let me just see if I understand this particular clause. The clause about making loans says that your client can take out a loan from the partnership funds in any amount of money, without, for any purpose at all, without paying any interest, and not having to pay for at least 20 years, right?
That's not what the document says, Your Honor.
Well, what part of what I said isn't correct?
Well, I would just direct your attention.
Is that your client's position, what I just said, that he could take it out for any reason, including a personal reason?
No, sir.
Oh, so he could only take it out for a partnership reason?
Right, and did.
I see. And what was the partnership reason?
To pursue the litigation in New York.
Well, wasn't the other side says that some of the loans, like maybe $1 million worth of loans, were made after the Second Circuit denied the case. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, in that case, I would direct your attention to, if I may just go through the documents very briefly, because I think they address all of this. These are factual disputes. And the problem is Dr. Kartenhauer in 2004 at the beginning and then 2006 at the end made factual statements in front of the notary public. This is the way it was.
What I'm focusing on, you can have an unconscionable contract even if the person agreed to it. And I just want to focus for a moment on whether
Absolutely.
It's unconscionable. So tell
sure.
me, with respect to the loans, what's wrong with I propositioned it in the way that the other side had raised it. And I'm also interested in how that much money could be loaned for a partnership purpose after the Second Circuit had already affirm the dismissal.
It's covered in the documents here in 2006. That's actually addressed in the sworn document. If I may just
briefly
go through that. Starting at page 162, and this is, I mentioned it's bookended. We start in 2004, page 162 of the appendix, the third paragraph.
A lot of appendixes, which...
I'm sorry, this is the appellant's appendix. Page 162, paragraph 3. We each agree that although Robertson is an attorney and although the business partnership between Cartonnell and Robertson will serve as its sole business, the provision of legal services, at no time prior to now has Robertson been, nor at any time in the future shall Robertson be Cartonnell's attorney, nor shall any attorney-client relationship between Cartonnell and Robertson be applied. And even says, we also agree that as long as the business partnership between us continues to exist, there can, in any event, be no attorney-client relationship between Cartonnell and Robertson. Then going on to paragraph 6, and this deals with some of the tax issues, we further acknowledge and agree that the partnership will utilize loan provisions from the working capital to the partners until such time as there is taxable income, and that our choice in doing so is for reasons related to perceived tax benefits. Paragraph 8. This is truly critical. About midway through that paragraph, further, Cartonnell agrees that he has already received from Robertson and is in possession of sufficient information regarding all of Robertson's legal businesses and cases when the scope of the partnership, and he goes through and says that it's his duty to keep up with what's going on and with his case, and that since he's not a lawyer, he is to consult with outside legal counsel to stay apprised of this stuff.
I appreciate we're not yet at the question I asked you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We're not yet at the question I asked you, which is, can the funds be used for any purpose, and why did the loan being made after the case was already lost support the business purpose?
This document, I think, will answer that directly. Page 194, and this document was signed in front of a let's see, this one's not notarized, but it's signed by the parties, undisputed, April 9, 2006. The second paragraph, it says that litigation has been presently dismissed by the district court and the defendant's motion dismissed. It's currently on appeal. All that's stated in paragraph 2. And then up in paragraph 1, he covenants that all the partnership duties have been fulfilled, that he's looked over everything, that he doesn't have any problems with it. And so, again, this goes to the enforceability.
But this is dated April 2006. My recollection is that the loan was made in, I think, April 2007, right?
Correct. But as it states in paragraph 3, that they are unanimously agreeing and voting in the affirmative to embark on new legal representation.
And this is new legal representation with respect to that case?
No, a different case.
A different case.
And so that explains it as a matter of law. And then there's one other document that I would refer the court to.
Was there another case filed?
No, the research was done, but it was not filed because this case was filed and essentially shut down the activities of the partnership.
So what you're saying is that after the defense would be that after 2000, that the money from 2007 was going to be used for research in another case?
Correct.
The same kind of case or a different case?
Right, securities litigation.
But the same, with respect to the same.
No, sir. It says in here it's a new case. Paragraph 3 says wholly unrelated to the present litigation.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. That does answer the question. Okay.
And then on page 182, and this is the notarized document in front of a notary public, where Dr. Cartonnell says, and again this is from April of 2006. Second paragraph, Wade A. Robertson is not my attorney, and I have never engaged Wade A. Robertson as an attorney for any legal advice, so on and so forth. Second paragraph, or the one below that, any interactions that I've had or will have with Wade A. Robertson are strictly business relationships. And then he's going ahead and saying that there's not an attorney-client relationship here. The point is, going back to the interlocutory appeal, there is no chance of success on the merits if more than 3 years before the lawsuit was filed. He is saying in sworn documents that I knew all this stuff and I knew he's not my attorney. I have not only had the opportunity, but he's saying I have consulted with another attorney. And the position of the appellees is essentially, well, we can come in here to go to the trial court.
Part of their claim, just bear with me for 1 second.
Sure.
Part of their claim is that the money that was taken out in 2007 was taken out for a personal reason, to be used for personal investments and not for the partnership. That comes within the statute of limitations, doesn't it?
It would, but if he's saying that there's some kind of ongoing fraud or misconduct in the partnership, and he was supposedly aware of it in 2006, that...
Well, he wouldn't have been aware of it in 2006 because this particular loan took place in 2007. And there isn't a document that advises of the previous loan, is there?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it. Well, it's the document on page 194, and it just says all the duties, and this is somewhat general, have been duly met or otherwise waived by and with the consent of all partners herein.
Right, but I tell you, there is no document. Imagine the best case for the other side, which is that they trace both of these loans, and in fact the money goes into personal investment accounts of your client rather than into any expenditures for research or anything else. Their claim is that they didn't know about either of those specific things, and that the last one of those specific things came within the three-year period.
Well, that's false, and it's objectively false, because in the opposition brief, or the appellee's brief, they say, for example, that we didn't know about any of this till January of 2010. And our position is that he is, in these contracts, he said, I have an ongoing duty to monitor this stuff and keep up with it. And then he wants to come back when it suits his purpose and say, well, I didn't do any of that. And this guy was my attorney. And never mind that I said he wasn't my attorney. I was lying then, so you should believe me now. And it upends the enforceability of contracts.
Okay. Can I ask you one more question? I appreciate this on a slightly separate question, but there's a motion for sanctions against you,
which
you responded to. Can I just ask this question? Like, when will you pay up? So then we know whether or not there's a contempt issue or not.
Well, Your Honor,
what do you think is reasonable with respect to that?
I would say 3 months, if that's...
3 months.
Did you see my response?
Yes. Okay. I understand your point, which is a good one, which our order doesn't give any date.
Right.
Okay. So if we were to figure out what an appropriate date would be, 3 months would be appropriate.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Patrick Kearney. I represent William C. Carton Howard, Jr. We're here asking the court to affirm Judge Huvel's interlocutory injunction. And I guess the starting point is from what Mr. Clevenger talks about, is that there's some documents that Dr. Carton Howard signed or allegedly signed stating that I release everybody. I release Mr. Robertson. I know everything. Therefore, there is no case.
They say allegedly. Do they dispute that these signatures?
Yeah, Dr. Carton Howard disputes the vote agreement. He does not have any recollection of signing it. That's interesting. One of the documents that wasn't signed in front of a notary, he doesn't have any recollection of the vote agreement, April 9, 2006. But the other documents, the release agreement, the indemnification, the attestation of no attorney, the partnership agreements, he signed. There's just no two ways about it. He signed. And Mr. Clevenger will say he signed it, therefore you lose. But that ignores the law of the District of Columbia, Interdonado versus Interdonado. Old Mrs. Interdonado signed a release. She couldn't really read English, but she had it read to her. She was a really smart lady. The D.C. Court of Appeals said, you know, the fact that you can't read English doesn't get you out of it, but let's take a look at what happened underneath the release. And if there are fraudulent statements made to you about the release, then the release is no good. And in that case, there were statements saying that Paul Interdonado, an attorney, had turned over the corpus of a trust to her, when in fact he'd only turned over part of the corpus of the trust. And she didn't know whether he had the whole trust or part of the trust. And with respect to her son, who signed off on it, there was a question of whether or not it was supported by consideration. The release was considered by consideration, because the consideration stated was, I will pay you this amount from the trust. And in that case, Paul Interdonado had the obligation to pay it, and the D.C. Court of Appeals said, well, there's no consideration if he just does what he's supposed to do. So a release, which on its face, everybody looked at and agreed, was a release, is not enforceable.
You're going to the merits. You've got a trial coming up in February.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't understand how you get past what the Supreme Court has told us in Grupo. You can't have an injunction freezing assets when a party has not demonstrated an equitable claim to the assets. The district court did not rely on an equitable claim. You pled some. The district court did not rely on it.
I pled it, and I'd have to...
I'm not talking about what you pled.
Yes, Your Honor.
You pled accounting rescission, dilution of partnership, establishment of a constructive trust. That's not what the district court rested on. I don't know how you get past... No, I've looked at this over and over again. The district court absolutely did not rest on any of those. It rested on only on fiduciary duty and conversion, and they are not equitable, and you try and skirt that. But the law is absolutely clear, and I don't know how you get past 64 either. The Supreme Court is very clear that 65 cannot be used in a situation like this, and it certainly can't be used to overcome the requirements of Rule 64.
Your Honor, I agree that it can't be. You have to be able to trace, and this court said it in the Ellipso, and you were on the panel in that, and there has to be an equitable claim to that money.
There has to be. The district court has to rest its finding, not you had to have pled it. This is a preliminary injunction. The district court's taking a big step if there's no equitable foundation here. This is unheard of. As the Supreme Court says in Grupo, we can't allow this. You can't allow people preemptively to grab assets in a damages case in advance of the final determination by using a preliminary injunction. The court said that's absolutely unacceptable, and we followed that in Ellipso. So now I look to the district court and what the district court is resting on here, because we're looking at what the district court's findings are. It may be that they could find constructive trust as a basis to support, or could find a dilution of partnership, as whatever. That's not what the district court did.
Your Honor, the proof in the district court, what...
No, the findings of the district court. It is not what we would do with the record of the district court. It's what the district court based its preliminary injunction on. And you know as well as I do, the district court did not base its preliminary injunction on any of your equitable claims.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I believe it did, and here's the reason.
Well, you point me, no, I don't want your assessment as to why they probably ought to have, or it might have been in the back of her head. Point me to the record.
Your Honor, I don't have a record that says that there's a constructive
trust. You absolutely do not.
But, Your
Honor.
You
have the record that I'm reciting.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and that record does not pass Grupo.
Well, with due respect, Your Honor, if you look at the exhibit which the court created, the court's exhibit number 2, which specifically goes through the tracing of the funds in order. You don't trace funds unless there's a specific reason to trace funds. And the tracing of funds goes to the establishment of the
constructive
trust.
You've got to have a specific. I mean, Grupo is a huge decision. The court is so firm in what it says there. We will not allow preliminary injunctions to hold assets to pay damages. Make the case easy. The district court says this is a straight damages case. And I'm worrying that if the plaintiff wins, these people may have moved their assets. I'm freezing them. Can they do that?
No, Your Honor.
Absolutely not.
And that's kind of what happened in Dorfman.
No, wait. That cannot be done. No confusion.
No, Your Honor.
That's what happened here. Because you pled more than that, but the district court did not rest on any of the equitable.
And I proved more than that, Your Honor.
You may even have proved more than that, but the district court, I don't know whether you did or not, but the district court did not make the findings to support it.
And, Your Honor, with due respect, I believe this court has the ability to rest not
only on... That's a different argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, now you tell me why we can, on our own authority, do what the district court failed to do, because if all you have is what the district court did, this has to be reversed.
Your Honor, this court has the authority to affirm not only on the grounds that the court found... the district court, but also on any grounds in the record.
Give me a preliminary injunction case.
I don't have a I just have a general case, Your Honor. I don't have a preliminary injunction case.
You know, in summary judgment cases, we...
Yes, Your Honor.
May,
that's all I have
I wasn't
is a summary.
Aware, yeah, I wasn't
no, Your
aware
Honor.
Of any preliminary injunction case which require findings.
I just don't have it, Judge.
Yeah,
but
I mean, see, just so you understand, my view is I don't know what the district court could do on a remand, but I don't know how we can't remand it and say you cannot issue a preliminary injunction on this record the way you have made your findings. It's not possible under the law. And you've conceded. She did not make the findings. You said you think you gave her enough to do it, but she didn't do it.
Yeah, I think it's implicit in her findings, but I can't go any further than that.
Well, implicit is the best you can do.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the statute of limitations, there is no issue about the statute of limitations. The last act was in April 2007. And if you go back to November 2006, the letter that Dr. Kartenhauer wrote to Mr. Robertson, he wrote, "I'm relying upon you." He didn't know anything. He just didn't know what was going on. On the fact of, "I am not your attorney," that shows what's going on in this case. Is the record was sufficient to show that Mr. Robertson actually wrote a will, wrote the dissolution of a business that Mr. Kartenhauer was involved in. He acted as his attorney. He gave him advice during the course of this case, told him about how great this class action was and why it was a great class action case, and gave him the only kind of advice that lawyers could give as lawyers, and that continued at least through November 2006. With respect to, in order to go through rescission, you still have to prove fraud or breach of fiduciary duty. And, Your Honor, that's...
Are you equating those two?
Your Honor, they're separate. You can get rescission for fraud. You can get rescission for breach of fiduciary duty. It can go either way.
She talks a lot about breach of fiduciary duty.
She talks more about breach of fiduciary
duty. I'm not sure that fraud is specifically mentioned at all.
And there's...
Conversion and there's breach of fiduciary.
Yes, Your Honor. And
okay, so...
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you saying that the breach of fiduciary duty fills the gap that Judge Edwards was
absolutely
identifying?
Not.
Well, it
absolutely not.
It fills the gap on rescission. Under Judge Edwards, it's not
no,
the constructive
it's a damages claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, can I ask about that? I'm just wondering whether you're giving up a little bit easily under the force of the questioning. So let me ask the first question, which is, were either Grupo or Ellipso or this argument raised in the district court?
No, Your Honor.
Well, in Ellipso, we said when it's not raised, it's waived.
Yes, Your Honor, and that
so
we
that should be the end.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if every question Judge Edwards asked you is correct, the fact that the argument was not made in the district court, that's exactly what we said in Ellipso, waives the argument about not being able to attach this.
And this is all novel arguments in front of this court.
Okay. So moving to the second question, in Ellipso, the court says that if the money was taken by a fraud and not a firm, that would be equitable. And in the Supreme Court's opinion in Grupo, it says that rescission of a contract induced by fraud is equitable and a freeze order is appropriate, correct?
Indeed, Your Honor.
All right, so now let's take a look at the district court's opinion in this case. And I appreciate it as a bit, there are a lot of statements in this regard. But she says on 324 that there is also evidence that Mr. Robertson intentionally misled Mr. Kartenhauer as to his actions. That's a claim, that's a fact finding which would support fraud, not a fact finding that supports breach of contract, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. It went both ways in the court.
And in
that's what she found, huh?
Yes, Your Honor.
She found it intentionally.
She rested the injunction on that.
She rested it on the entire case, Your Honor. This was overwhelming evidence.
Well, then you suddenly changed. What was obvious to you and me is less obvious now?
114.
No, Your Honor.
Let's see, where was that? That's on page 324 of the appellee's appendix. And then she also appears to rest on a claim, on an argument about likelihood of success in the merits on a claim of unconscionability. Right?
Yes, using the Walker Hill case.
Yes. And unconscionability is an equitable doctrine. It's not a legal doctrine.
That is correct.
And on page Appellee's Appendix 329, she says that you can get a freeze by showing it's necessary to prevent consumption, dissipation, or fraudulent conveyance of the assets.
Yes, sir.
Fraudulent conveyance is also an equitable doctrine, isn't it? Or isn't it?
Statutory.
That's statutory. Okay, good. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We'd ask for affirmance.
One moment. The argument that was not raised, that you and Judge Carlin were just discussing, that was not raised by Mr. Robertson below, is that the argument about the authority under Rule 65?
There was no discussion of attachment before judgments.
All right, but that whole prospect was raised, was it not, at the hearing for the first time? It was not in any papers prior to the hearing.
No, Your Honor. In the what we were asking for was a freeze and we put in our request, and I put specifically the motion in, because at the end of the motion, it specifically asks that the monies be deposited into the registry of the court. I had a more discussion on it at the end of the hearing about my reasoning for doing it, and it had to do with protection against a bankruptcy, because we were looking for, in the case of a constructive trust, and I specifically argued that to Judge Huvel.
Where is that in the appendix? I have a vague recollection of this, but I didn't think it was I wasn't satisfied with it before.
It's Pelley's Appendix 44. That's what you're talking about, the memorandum of points and authorities.
Yes, Your Honor.
The emergency motion. Can I just ask one? I just want to clarify on that question Judge Ginsburg asked you. It's not just that he didn't raise Rule 64. He also didn't raise the arguments under Rule 65 that a freeze requires an equitable fact-finding, right?
There was absolutely no argument.
No argument, no citation to Grupo, no citation to Lipso?
No, that all came up afterward, Your Honor. She actually cited Ellipso in her decision, if I recall.
Right, so I'm looking at Appellee's Appendix 44, which begins with a reference to Rule 65C. Is that where I should be?
Yeah, that's right there. I think it's at the middle of the sentence. It says the money itself should be frozen or deposited in the registry of the court.
Yes, Your Honor. That's as far as we went.
All right, and was this, this is in support of a motion, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And where's the response to that motion?
I did not attach the response in my appendix, Your Honor.
Do you know where it can be found?
It would be in the pleadings themselves, and I don't know that they were in Mr. Robertson's.
And does Mr. Robertson not respond to Rule 65, or does he?
My recollection, and that's only a recollection, is that the response was to the merits under Holiday Tours and the existence of whether or not a injunction should issue, not whether to the merits of the freeze or putting the money into the registry of the court.
Let me follow up on this, because I'm confused now on this alleged waiver. Your motion recited both equitable claims and claims for damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So what was he supposed to do? Preserve. He raised it. The district court then issued an injunction based only on those things which he could not rest on solely. That was after the fact. He had no reason to know that that was the way the district court was going to. See, he joined the fight. There was a legitimate fight.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the district court could have issued a preliminary injunction, arguably, based on your equitable claims. That's not what she did. You say it's implicit that she meant to do otherwise. I'm saying, as a judge looking at it from my vantage point, she rested on the wrong things, and she made no findings on the right things. Now, where did he waive anything? He can't then appeal and say that's legal error. He did in his brief to us. He doesn't have to, under the normal federal rules, contest findings in the motion that's issued by the district court below in order to preserve the claim.
But he didn't argue in front of the court that she didn't have the power.
She did have the power on the motion that you submitted. She had the power to make the right finding. She didn't do it. He then got a final judgment. He appealed it, and he raised the issue in a timely fashion. That was the first time they knew to raise the issue in a timely fashion. He had no reason to know in advance. Why would he argue in advance? So incidentally, don't rest on the wrong thing. And the district court recited the case law and did it incorrectly. So he's arguing Ellipso, you misapplied Ellipso because you applied it only to damages. You're not resting, you're making no findings on the equitable matters.
And
isn't that right? So where's the waiver?
Your Honor,
where's the waiver?
The waiver is that she made a specific finding that Ellipso applied and that she made specific findings on the tracing of the money.
Well, we can look at that and say we hear you, but you were wrong because your findings only go to damage matters, not equitable. Okay, so where did he waive anything?
Well, let me. He did not make the following argument. My opponents say that you can freeze the assets based on either equitable or fact claims. That's not correct. The court only has the power to freeze assets if it makes an equitable finding. He did not make that argument.
Did you say that in your motion? I missed that. Your motion said, Your Honor, you can do one of two things, one of three things. You can rest on equitable, or you can rest on non-equitable, or you can rest on both. You didn't argue that, did you?
Your Honor, I didn't. I was arguing the court's equitable power because
of course you were.
Can't.
So what Judge Garland is posturing is not the scenario.
You argued.
They weren't on notice, right, that you didn't suggest to the court that she had the authority to do this, right? So he didn't know there was a contest, right?
It was my motion to the court that she could do it, yes.
That she could do it on damages only?
No, Your Honor.
No, of course not. So he didn't have reason to know that that was an issue. You recited the equitable matters in your motion, right?
Yes.
Yes, okay. I'm actually talking to my colleague, not to you.
Well, here's what...
I'm trying to understand.
Talking back to my colleague, it sounds like the definition of sandbagging. I mean, you wait until after you just find out what ground the court rules against you on, and then you make an argument you didn't make to the court to advise the court of what kinds of fact findings are required. That seems to me the definition of sandbagging. That's what we ordinarily make
that
as the definition of waiver.
It's ellipso, and ellipso is clear in what you can and cannot do. That's strange.
My only comment on that, Your Honor, is if you cite ellipso, then we should be discussing what ellipso is and isn't.
Right.
And the argument wasn't made.
I want to point out that you did say 44 in conclusion of your memorandum, when you just after the reference to Rule 65. An equity case as serious as this suggests that waiving the bond is appropriate, another form of relief that you sought. So you characterized the case in a way that would have qualified it for,
right,
for the relief that you got. And you're saying if the district court didn't make the necessary foundational finding for that we should do so.
I think you can, because I think the record's all there, Your Honor. And the court was very specific on finding where the money came from, where the money went. This was all Dr. Kartenhauer's investment. It had gone into Mr. Robertson's personal account. It was taken after the litigation was dead and after Dr. Kartenhauer had actually started trying to conduct an investigation. He'd written Mr. Watts, an attorney down in the South in 2007, and then all of a sudden the money moves out the door, and it's all traceable to Dr. Kartenhauer. And for those reasons, Your Honor, when you look at the entire facts of this case, there are equitable claims, and a constructive trust was proven.
Thank you, Mr. Kearney.
I just ask, on the sanctions issue, I take it you have no objection of being paid in 3 months, is that right?
I have no objection to being paid, Your Honor, but my objection to this is that we're getting tossed with motion after motion, and apparently...
But not in this court.
Not in this court anymore.
Well, then you got to bring it somewhere else.
Yeah, I know, we're working on it, but there doesn't seem to be...
I'm not giving you legal advice, I'm just saying
that
we don't have any authority over what goes on in other court. You understand that?
You could, if I filed a motion and asked for it under the Martin Trigona standards that this court has followed in other cases. We haven't asked for that. We asked for it below from Judge Huvel, and for the time being, she's denied it without prejudice.
We haven't barred Mr. Clevenger or his client from suing in another court.
No, Your Honor, you have not. I haven't asked for it.
Well, whether you asked for it or not, we haven't done it. So
no,
it certainly can't be in violation of an order we haven't issued.
No, my only comment on the other filings is I think it makes a statement on he was told to stop doing it in this court, so he stopped, and he started doing it in other courts.
Seems like an argument you're going to have to make somewhere else.
I am.
Thank you, Mr. Kearney. Is there time? Do you want to hear the rebuttal? Yeah. Okay. Okay, Mr. Clevenger, give 3 minutes rebuttal.
Your Honor. One statement briefly that Mr. Kearney made was that Dr. Kartenhauer, quote, has no recollection of signing the vote agreement. That's not sufficient evidentiary matter to say that this is not applicable.
Well, it stipulates to the others, so it's not terribly.
Right. So this whole idea of some kind of fiduciary breach is precluded as a matter of law. If he's already signed documents saying he was not my attorney, he was not acting as my attorney, he could not act as my attorney. I did consult with other attorneys. He wants to have it both ways. He wants to be able to sign sworn documents in front of a notary public saying one thing, but then when he wants to upend the agreement, he wants to be able to come back into court and say, well, no, that's not true. I didn't consult with an attorney. No, that's not true. Actually, he was my attorney. I mean, this, again, he's contradicting himself. The issue of unconscionability, he has to go to the documents themselves to show that they are unconscionable. He's not doing that. What he's doing is he's saying there's all this external stuff that renders them unconscionable. Now, you can do that under some circumstances. The problem is that he's doing it on the basis of factual allegations that he's already sworn are not the case. He's already sworn that this man has not been my attorney. I'm releasing him. He never has been. And so you just can't have it both ways. I understand that he's 83 years old, but you know, it's one thing to say that, well, this contract was written in Latin and there's all this legalese and I didn't understand the legalese, but these are factual averments. He's saying, not only did I have the opportunity, but I did consult with another attorney. That attorney told me not to do this and I'm doing it anyway. I don't know how you get around that. There's no confusion there. This whole argument of unconscionability is rooted in him coming back 3, 4, 5 years later and saying, well, yes, I signed that and I said that, but it's not true. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Clevenger. Mr. Kearney, thank you. Case is submitted.
Last rebuttal, back and put on the ball.